My name is Renee Marshall. I'm 41 years old. Today is September 17th, 2019, and I'm speaking with Maria Quisi, who is a podcaster. We are recording in Irvine, California.
And my name is Maria Quisi, and I am actually a speech pathologist by background and also a podcaster.
Thank you so much for coming to chat with me.
You're welcome.
We met at a podcaster's meetup, and after hearing just a little snippet of what you do and what's your subject matter expertise, I wanted to bring you here to learn more about you. Can I start with like the beginning question? How did you choose caregiving as a topic of your podcast?
It kind of goes back several years, actually, before the podcast existed. I'll go back about 5 or 6 years. I was working at a hospital on the stroke unit, and I was going to see a gentleman during his lunch time, and because of his stroke, he had difficulty swallowing. And because of that, he needed to be on a pureed diet in order to eat and swallow safely. And I walked in the room, and he lifted the lid off of his lunch tray, and he looked at what was on the plate, and he gave me this expression with the saddest face I've ever seen, because he didn't want to eat it. It didn't look appetizing at all. And I totally understood. And so when I walked out of the room that day, I thought, there's got to be a better way. And then this idea hit me. And I thought, well, I'm always in the kitchen. I'm always changing recipes to suit my taste. I can do better than that. So I went home and I started creating recipes for people who needed modified diets. And I started posting them on a blog. So that's kind of was the very beginning. Once I had enough recipes, I put them into a cookbook. And that's now on Amazon. It's called Think Outside the Blender.
Oh!
Because you don't need a blender for all of the recipes. And then from there, I actually built a website because I wanted to have a place where people could go for resources for swallowing and recipes and things like that. And that kind of grew into some other consulting opportunities. And through that, I had started networking with a lot of people in the senior care industry. And there's just so many wonderful people out there who care about our seniors. And then that eventually, I should back up a little bit. During this time, I've also spent 10 years as a massage therapist, and I've also taught yoga for many years. So I have a background of how to manage stress. I work with a lot of people that are stressed out. So I have kind of that in the background also.
Right.
It's not been a linear path. And then most recently, just starting to think about caregivers from a professional standpoint, from working in the hospital, seeing patients and having their families there and being in the room, let's say, when the doctor comes in and has a conversation with the family, and the family's dealing with, you know, the stress of their loved one being in the hospital, they're dealing with a new diagnosis, lots of new medical terminology, and they're overwhelmed. And I think a lot of them don't know where to turn to find resources. And I just realized, oh my gosh, I've got all this information, or at least I know where to access it. I know where to find it. And then someone suggested, oh, have you ever thought about doing a podcast? Okay, I'll figure it out. So it took me a couple of months to figure out the technical parts of it. And but once I started making a list of potential topics and also people to talk to, within a few minutes, I had a page-long list of topics and people. And I thought, okay, I think I have something here that might be worthwhile. So in April, I posted my first episode.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah.
I can see how your resources can help so many people, the senior population, those who have had strokes, those with, you know, a new health diagnosis. Does this affect those with chemotherapy?
Sure. People who are going through cancer treatments, for sure. Not only the person, but their caregivers and their loved ones who are going along that ride with them. For sure.
How do you reach your audience besides podcast and through your blog and your recipe book? I took a peek, and and there are so many conferences and so many speakers for those who are hospital professionals, those who work in senior care. How do you reach out to your audience?
Yeah, so in addition to what you just mentioned, I still continue with the networking with the people who are involved in senior care. And I've also spoken at various support groups, for example, maybe an Alzheimer's support group or stroke survivors support group. I also spoke at a speech pathology conference last year, which was really exciting. So, yeah, just various speaking engagements. And then I'm also on LinkedIn and Facebook, so I try to post things there too.
That's excellent. There's so multiple ways to find you and find those resources too, especially with your background as a speech pathologist, having worked in a hospital, and you describe your path as nonlinear, but it's so closely related, as far as whole health, the massage aspect, and also just what happens when you take a health diagnosis home, and how do you care for oneself, or how do you care for someone who is going through difficulty swallowing, therefore difficulty speaking, and difficulty eating. For example, I think of my mother, who is passed. She had Alzheimer's, and besides Alzheimer's, she also had a kidney failure. So she had a dialysis program that she went to. One of the first things she told me is, "Renee, everything that I eat tastes different now." Just the sensation of food in her mouth and just like the sodium levels that she perceived. It's like everything is way too outrageously salty or too bland. So it's, you know, it's amazing the lack of information that's out there of what to do for a loved one, because instantly the thought of, you know, oh, make soups for mommy, or make, throw things in a blender for mommy, it's like, I miss my ribs. I miss eating barbecued ribs. Would you like to talk a little bit about your kitchen experiments, first of all?
Oh, sure. Well, once I got home after that light bulb moment, I think I made a few things like split pea soup and just simple basic things, and I realized this is pretty easy to do. You don't need great, you know, experience in the kitchen. You don't need a lot of expensive equipment. And I really tried to keep my recipes with only a few ingredients, because I wanted to keep them simple and healthy, and things that people could recreate at home. And then I started taking photos of them, and I really try to make them look appetizing, because I think the presentation is so important. You know, when you look at a plate of typical pureed food, for example, in the hospital, it's, everything's the same color, it's the same shape. You might not recognize what it is aside from the mashed potatoes, you know, and I think that's what that one gentleman was reacting to, is just that, you know, they say we eat with our eyes. That's a common expression, and it's actually true. I recently heard about a study that found when you visually recognize the food on your plate, your brain sends signals to your stomach to start preparing to digest that particular food. So recognizing what you're eating is really important to get the most nutrition out of it and digesting it. So it's a common phrase, but it's actually got some science behind it.
We eat with our eyes.
Yeah, and I think you look at so many cultures around the world and think about the presentation of the food, and that's a big part of it.
That's so very true. Immediately when I think of soft foods, I think of how much I enjoy Indian food and Indian buffets, and how things are lovely and creamy and soft, but so colorful.
And flavorful, and too,
flavorful,
right?
Yeah. Right? So when you give me this very poignant story of your patient opening that lid and looking so disappointed with the look of his food, what are some things that you have found that really do create that eye appeal?
Sure, you can use foods that have deep colors, like instead of using a regular potato, use a yam. Those are that deep orange and red colors of a yam. Or using a sauce like a red tomato sauce or a green pesto sauce. So really bringing a lot of colors to your dish. There's also been research that shows that red dishware makes food look more appetizing. In fact, there's an Alzheimer's Day Center in Huntington Beach, and in their kitchen, that's all they use is red plates and red cups and red silverware. So that's part of just the eye appeal, making it look appetizing. And also creating shape and height. If you think about most pureed food, it's just like a blob.
It's true.
But if you can use something, let's say, polenta, which you can buy already. It's in like a tube.
Yes.
But when you cut it and you cook it, it retains its shape. But if you don't cook it too long, it'll keep that soft texture to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll give you some shape and some height, which is, again, much more interesting than just a flat blob on a plate.
That's so true. I think of my dining out experiences, and polenta definitely can be molded into interesting shapes, and oftentimes food to be more appealing for the diner is maybe shaped in a pyramid shape, that height, that 3D image rather than flat. And
I have to say something about 3D, though, because so 3D printers.
Please do.
So there are printers that will print out food, 3D printers. So number one, would you want to eat something that came out of a 3D printer? I'll leave that up to you. But the other thing is I heard about an engineering professor out of Columbia University, and he and his team are working on these 3D printers for food. And so they were printing out all sorts of things, and they had a group of people doing taste tests. And the main complaint of the taste testers was that they didn't recognize the food. For example, they would take broccoli, but it would come out as like this gray pyramid shape form. And so you don't know what to expect when you eat that. And I think that was a complaint from the taste. So you need to recognize the food that you're eating. For an example, another thing that I do is if you take, for example, an acorn squash and you cut it in half and you scoop out the seeds and you bake it, well, the pulp of it is it's like mashed potato consistency.
Mm-hmm.
But if you leave it in its shell, so to speak, you recognize what it is.
Oh, I understand. But the container.
Exactly. Same thing with avocado. You know, if you cut the avocado in half and take out the seed, the inside is still pretty soft, but you look at it, oh, that's an avocado. So having that visual recognition is so important.
So I'll sort of repeat, a red plate using the actual vegetable as a natural container are some tips.
Mm-hmm.
Not altering the color too much and the shape of broccoli, because then it becomes some sort of alien food. Those are great tips. For those who are less familiar with, like, they have not had any experience themselves, or they don't know anyone in their circle about the difficulty swallowing, does that include, could you describe it? So, like, for example, if a person were to drink a milkshake with, like, chunks of strawberry, like, how small is too small?
It really depends on the individual person and why they're having the difficulty swallowing. For example, someone who's had a stroke might have a lot of weakness and numbness along one side of their body. So if you could imagine, you can't feel one half of your face, like when you've been to the dentist, and it's numbed up, it's probably going to be really hard to chew something like a piece of broccoli or a piece of chicken or salad. So the blended foods that are smooth, like the shake without the chunks of strawberry or like a yogurt or an applesauce consistency, are likely more easy to manage in your mouth and then when you swallow. Someone who's had cancer, head and neck cancer, may have had surgery or half of their tongue removed or their jaw removed. Again, they're going to have trouble managing those more solid consistencies. So making it more blended and smooth is just going to be easier orally to manage.
That gives a very vivid picture of the application. Thank you. I was also wondering, in addition to difficulty swallowing, I would imagine this affects those who don't produce enough saliva also for various medical reasons or injuries.
So someone who's, again, recovering from head and neck cancer, maybe because of radiation, maybe their mouth is very dry. So we hear that a lot. That's a common complaint for our patients. So what you can do is just make sure you're brushing your teeth frequently. Some people like to suck on hard candies. There's different products you can buy, artificial saliva, that you can just kind of either rinse your mouth with, or you can just brush it on your tongue to keep your tongue moist. I actually just recently learned from a patient, there are little little tablets called Xylomelts that you just stick to your gum or your tooth overnight.
All right.
It just over time gradually dissolves and keeps your mouth moist overnight. So
it's great to know so many resources, things that a person can make, a person can buy, a person already has in the kitchen, like a red plate, for example. That is such a relief to hear, because the way I picture it is this difficulty swallowing from injury disease can happen to anyone at any time, at any age.
And we take swallowing for granted until it's taken away from you. We do it every day. We do it several times a day. When all of a sudden you can't swallow, it's life-changing.
Right. You're definitely providing information that fills a gap that a lot of people don't think of. The only reason it resonated with me or had some familiarity, in my first marriage, my husband was a forensic economist, and he would price out what it would cost for home care for those who are severely injured at work. It could be nursing care, but also feeding bibs and other things for adults. Would you be able to talk a little bit about increasing like the dignity of eating, since you already gave such a great example of eye appeal?
Absolutely. And actually, we'll start with the bibs.
Please
because
do.
That's
yeah,
one of
please
my,
do.
One of my favorite things to share.
So fashionable. And when I looked at them, I was like, I think that would be great.
If you've ever been in a nursing home, for example, during a mealtime, you get the folks who need assistance eating. They get wheeled up to a table. They get a terry cloth bib put on them, and they get fed with a spoon. Well, who eats with a bib and gets fed by a spoon? Babies. But these are adults, you know, and they deserve more respect. So I have discovered through a search online, there's a company called Dinerware, and they make fashionable adult dining scarves. And I'm sorry I didn't bring one with me today, but they're made out of various fabrics, and they're like microfiber fabrics, so they're very durable. They come in different colors, and you can either just, you know, put it around your neck like a scarf. Some have a little fastener, and it's something that's nice enough you could wear to a restaurant, and it's something that an adult would wear. So it's so much nicer than having this, you know, baby's bib put on you. The other thing with the spoon is that a lot of the items, if they're not too runny and like a shake, but if they do have some texture or to them, you could still eat them with a fork. And I just think it's so nice to be able to offer someone a fork to eat if they might be doomed to this life of pureed food. They think they can only use a spoon, but it's not necessarily the case. The other thing is, oftentimes what I hear in the hospital setting is staff will refer to those people that need assistance as feeders. And I don't like that term because it's very dehumanizing. I read a note from a nurse once, and this totally changed my my perception, and he referred to his patient as a dependent diner. Oh, yay! Yes, this person needs assistance, but they're dining, you know, so thinking about the language.
The phrasing.
Yes.
That phrasing makes such a difference.
Yeah.
Feeder versus dependent diner.
Yeah, or just someone who needs assistance, you know.
Mm-hmm. This is just like just another example of phrasing. This is not related to caregiving, but I was speaking to someone who was an advocate of bike safety, and he changed my thinking by saying, okay, we call it bicyclists. We call it, you know, instead of pedestrians or drivers. He really insisted on creating a movement to say people on bikes. I said, why more words? And he said, well, to humanize it, to humanize the issue. Just let you remember that it's a neighbor, it's a fellow human being on the road.
And you put the person first rather than what they are or what they're dealing with.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Please continue. Like, I love hearing about these resources about dignity.
Make it social. You know, a lot of people who have difficulty swallowing feel isolated. For example, in the nursing home, they might be the only one in their group who is eating this modified diet. And that can be isolating, or maybe the only one in their family, you know, if they're at home, who's eating these modified types of foods. So, and isolation can lead to depression. There have been studies that show that people who have dysphagia, which is the term for difficulty swallowing, and modified diets, are more vulnerable to being depressed just because of the difficulty swallowing.
It makes sense.
So we know that making, when you bring more people together to eat a meal, you eat more. I mean, think about it. I come from a big Italian family, right? So we, our gatherings usually revolve around food, but that's not the primary reason we're there. Mm-hmm. You know, we're there to be together and socialize and feel like part of a group. I had a gentleman come in once for an outpatient swallow study, and he'd had a kind of a rare neuromuscular disorder that affected the muscles of his face and his neck and his swallowing. So he'd already had a feeding tube for a while. And he came in, and his wife was with him, and she said, you know, he just wants to know if he can eat a few bites of soup so he can go out with his friends.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really about the soup. It's about being with your buddies.
Yeah.
You know?
That really does make sense. The social aspect of dining together. I think of a friend of mine who became injured. And one of the things when he started using a wheelchair is that he actually didn't want to eat while we were dining together with other friends because he was self-conscious. And it's actually true.
Sure.
Some people would be rude and stare at him when he eight. So I love this idea of normalizing it. Normalizing, absolutely. And creating an idea of eating is part of the social experience, time with family, like you said, time with friends. I'm really curious about what you see as the next frontier of your subject matter expertise. Are there places where you know, people might not be part of a community already, like a nursing home, but who can go and have a meal once a week together as a gathering, not necessarily a church, not necessarily a nursing home. Mm. And it's not about finances. Mm-hmm. It's about dining together.
I love that idea. And let's see where it goes. I know this idea of creating, you know, appetizing modified food. It's not just me. I work with a chef who is based out of Lausanne, Switzerland, who's he specializes in molecular gastronomy.
Ooh.
And so he's creating some amazing foods that are the correct texture. And I know he's reaching out to people in Europe, you know, the chefs at senior communities and skilled nursing and things. So it's happening there. It's also happening in Japan because Japan has a large elderly population. And I read one statistic where I don't know how recent this was, but there are more deaths from choking than car accidents in their elderly folks. So they are on board with creating, again, foods that are the correct texture but have that eye appeal. So it's starting to take on. There's also a chef in Australia who's working with a system of facilities like memory care and senior communities. And same thing, he's molecular gastronomy background. And so people are understanding the importance of this. So.
That is so encouraging, especially when you think of fine dining, cutting edge dining. It's molecular gastronomy.
Exactly.
So this really just elevates the dignity and the participation.
And like you said, normalizes it.
Normalizes it.
Yeah.
This is really encouraging. It's not just sauces and mushy foods.
Right.
In a sense, I mean, for me, I'm almost picturing, as you mentioned, like Switzerland and Japan. How great would it be to normalize it so that those who do have swallowing difficulty and those who don't have it yet can dine together? Like, let's have a picnic and then eat the same food, try out the same food, and know and enjoy the flavor and the eye appeal. That would be great to have it normalized.
Yeah, my friend who's a chef tells a great story of when he had brought some samples of his food to a skilled nursing facility, and the staff said, "Oh, we've got this one guy, he's so difficult, he doesn't want to eat any of his pureed food." And so my friend asked, "What's his favorite food?" And they said, "He would love to have a ham sandwich." Well, if you can imagine, you know, the bread and the ham. So my chef friend, his name is Gabriel Serrero, he figured it out. He figured out how to make the bread, the ham, the olive tamponade, you know, all these different things.
And you're making me hungry.
And it looks like a sandwich. And he brought this gentleman the sandwich, and he ate the whole thing. I mean,
that's incredibly moving and important. My eyes are also getting shiny as well. Maria, would you like to talk about that, the book that you brought in? I see it's Being Mortal.
Yeah, this is, I think, a really important book for anyone who's either got someone in their family who's aging or maybe even doing it professionally. Being Mortal is, Dr. Kawande is actually a surgeon, and he writes this book not only from personal experience that he has within his own family, but just what it is to be aging in our society and how do we take care of our elders and how we can do a better job of taking care of our elders. So this is something I've actually read several times and highly recommend to anyone who's, just working with the senior community.
Thanks for that title. It's called Being Mortal. And would you pronounce it once more time, the name?
Dr. Atul Gawande, G-A-W-A-N-D-E, and I apologize if I'm not pronouncing that correctly.
But what a great resource.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I wanted to mention that he also talks about in this book is having those end-of-life discussions with your family and with your physician.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have not yet filled out an advance directive for yourself, I highly recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're a younger person, you don't have to be elderly or facing end-of-life issues to have one filled out. So I actually brought one, and they're available online. If you just do a search for your state, an advance directive for healthcare, it's very easy to get. You can download it for free and print it out. So it has two parts. One part is you designate someone that you would want to make decisions for you in the event that you are not able to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I work in a hospital as a trauma center, so
right.
I see this. And the second part is that you get to describe in detail what you would want or not want at the end of your life. You know, do you want everything done at all costs? Do you want to have a tube down your throat for a ventilator? Do you want the dialysis? Do you want the CPR? Or do you want nothing? You know, do you want to be in your home surrounded by your family or something in between? And there's no right or wrong. It's just you get to decide. So you get to have that sense of control. And it takes the burden of making those tough decisions off of your family, which is probably one of the biggest advantages.
That's such a great tip. And immediately I think of my own advance directive that I completed. When I got to the point where it asked feeding tube or no feeding tube, I was thinking, aren't there more options than this? But I don't have, as you know, this is where you come in, Maria. especially if I'm unconscious.
How much time do we have left?
We have 17 minutes.
Oh my goodness.
I want to go where you want to share your expertise.
I'll give you my opinion on this. So there are definitely certain people where a feeding tube would be appropriate. I'm thinking of someone who's recovering from a short, maybe head and neck cancer, and it's just for a limited amount of time until they get enough strength back, and they need that nutrition for a short amount of time, certainly. Or you're a young person who's suffered a stroke, maybe in their 40s or 50s, and we're anticipating that they're going to recover eventually.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you another story. I had this gentleman who was, he was probably about 40 years old. He came into the hospital. He had a minor stroke, just affected his speech a little bit. He was still able to eat. He ended up having heart surgery because he had a lot of heart issues. Well, because of the surgery, the stroke worsened. So when he came out of the surgery, his speech was severely affected, and so was his swallowing. So he got a feeding tube. Well, it took a while, but over the course of several months, he was able to start eating again, regular solid foods, and eventually was able to have the feeding tube removed. In fact, I found out later that he had sent a photo to one of the charge nurses that he had gotten to know, and he had pulled up a shirt. He said, "Look, now I have two belly buttons," because he had a little scar from where the feeding tube was, you know. So and those are two examples of people where it certainly is appropriate. Where it is not appropriate, and there's a lot of evidence to support this, is someone, for example, who is at the very end stage of an advanced dementia, and they're, you know, they're no longer speaking, they can't swallow. When they're at that stage where their systems in their body are just shutting down, it actually can cause more harm than good. Or think of someone who has a feeding tube, but then they need to have their wrists restrained so they won't pull it out. Well, that's a quality of life issue.
I understand.
What else? Yeah, I think, you know, that
So, Maria, I was wondering, just for taking care of you, taking care of yourself, do you have a hobby or like a happy place where you go?
I do. I actually have a couple of happy places. One is the beach. I'm very fortunate that I live near the ocean and I can pretty much take a walk there anytime I like. And I love being close enough to smell the ocean air and see the waves. And so that's definitely one place. Mm-hmm. Another thing I like to do is volunteer at a place called the Shea Center. And it's a center for therapeutic writing. And it's a place where people with disabilities of all ages, I think, from 2 to there's no limit, I think, on their upper age limit can come and be on a horse. And I volunteer either leading or walking alongside the rider during a lesson. I also do a lot of grooming and tacking and scooping poop. That's the sweeping. Those are things that all need to be done, barn chores. But it's an environment that I spent a lot of time in growing up, and it's just, I love it.
We have something in common, too. Then I did not grow up with horses, but actually after college graduation, that was a treat to myself to take English horseback lessons. Mm-hmm. And just the association, the smell of the barn, the feel of the horses, and grooming the horse after a ride. I can see why you use the word therapeutic.
Yeah, and I'll have to share with you information that I learned fairly recently about why we feel so good around horses. And I don't know if I have it.
That's quite all right.
Have it with me. Here it is. There's a organization called the Heart Math Institute, and they have done a lot of research on the heart-brain connection and the energetic field that is emitted by the heart and the brain. And they found that the energetic field from the horse's heart extends far beyond them. And so that's why when we're in their vicinity, the proximity of horses, that's we feel at ease. We feel more at peace. So it's been studied.
That
I have a feeling
sense.
It's the same thing with other animals like dogs and things because I love, animals. It's been shown that being around animals can help reduce stress, reduce your blood pressure, reduce your heart rate. So
this is great. I love the research that you bring in, too. I was wondering why the horse that I rode was not very tall. His name was Dugan. He may have been a retired work pony. He wasn't very tall because I'm not very tall. I'm only 5'3", but I would just feel so at peace, even if at the end of the ride, he would swat me with his tail that was, like, stinky. I said, like, you know what? It's okay, Yeah, there's something about being around, like, it's very, like, a big, powerful animal. I'm just thinking if there's any sort of relation to also being near a big, powerful, everlasting ocean. That same sense. There's something timeless and tranquil about it. Did you want to talk some more? We have a few minutes, maybe 12 minutes remaining. What are some other things that are your happy, you have several happy places?
I do. And so I assembled all of these things into a list of self-care techniques that I think are easy to implement. They don't cost money. And especially if you're a burned out caregiver. I've heard from so many caregivers that they're overwhelmed, they're exhausted, they're isolated. So these are just some simple things they can do just for some self-help. For example, take 5 minutes and give yourself a foot massage. I actually taught this to my coworkers a little while ago. We took off our shoes and you can't do it. There's no wrong way. You can squeeze, you can massage, you can, just whatever feels good on your foot. I know after a long day, I'll sit on the couch and just spend a few minutes massaging my feet. Or if you have a partner at home, even better.
Yep.
Getting creative, whether it's drawing, painting, writing, being in the kitchen, building things, just spending a few minutes. I think it takes you out of the worry, stress place, and you focus your mind on this other part of the brain, the creative centers, and that can help to reduce stress. Getting out into nature, for sure, has been shown to help reduce stress, whether it's the beach or the ocean or the desert or the mountains or just taking a walk around the block, even for 5 minutes. It really helps to clear your head. Definitely get enough sleep, exercise, also asking for help. I think sometimes people, the people in the circle of people They don't realize that someone is in need.
Mm.
So you might have to be the one to reach out and say, you know what, can you help me with this? Or could you pick up these groceries for me? Or could you do this? And people, I think, would be more than happy to help. Finding group support, for example, if you are, you know, caring for someone with a stroke or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, find that support group. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of resources there. Eating well and staying hydrated, for sure. Laughter, if you can find something to laugh at every day, and it doesn't matter what, laughter helps activate your body's natural relaxation response.
Hmm.
I've got my go-to YouTube videos or whatever that, you know, if I need a little pick-me-up,
Is it like cat videos, dog videos?
There's a dog one. And it's actually a group that brings dogs to this office on Bring Your Dog to Work Day, and it's a bunch of stressed out people, and as soon as the dogs come in, the mood changes, you know, and so that's something for me. Also setting boundaries, knowing when to say no, because there's only so much you can do.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
We talked about spending time with animals. There's also meditation, but if you don't have the time or it's not something for you, just stop several times throughout the day. That's what I do when I'm at work, and I just breathe, and I notice what's in my surroundings. And it just brings you into that present moment. And when you're in the present, you're not worried about the future. You're not dwelling on the past. You're in the present. And so it's a very helpful thing to do. There's also something called the now practices, where you just stop for a moment and you think of, what am I hearing? What am I smelling? What am I tasting? What am I feeling? And you try to bring in information from all of your senses, whether you're standing in line at Trader Joe's or in the shower, you're washing dishes, whatever, you know, just stop and take that moment and notice what's coming in through all the senses.
Right. This is such great tips to, you know, great tips for the long run, or like the ultra marathon that is life. Life can be very wearying, especially if, you know, you're a caring person. So it makes sense to have that now practice and to have your happy place and to eat well and sleep well, and also just have many things in your life other than that.
Have a balance.
Main thing.
Yeah.
That balance. Yeah. Now, after you've reminded me, now does it feel so frivolous when after a day of work, I take out a pair of scissors and I do paper art. And I think, why do I do this?
Yeah.
Is it something from childhood? It's like, yes, it is something from childhood, but it's creative and it just takes my mind away from whatever
Exactly. So keep it up.
Thank you for that. And thank you so much
for
talking with me today and for just sharing all these resources. Is there something else that you wanted to add in the final 7 minutes or so?
Let's see. Just if you are a caregiver for someone, just definitely reach out for help and know that you're not alone.
Thank you so much, Maria. And there we are. Oh, my goodness.
Holy cow.
Holy cow. I'm just thinking, like, this record, as you know, when people listen to it, there's so many points where they can relate. You know, if they're a caregiver or if they're not a caregiver, or just someone in an occupation where, you know, there's a lot of their heart that's poured into it. It's just so useful.
Yay. So what's the next step?
So the next step is, are you finished recording the answers?